nothing, nothing on the problem of the trade union remains. But then it's not. It's very interesting. What Marx and Engels have to say on the subject of trade unions in general is important. They are clearly organisation and paraphrasing, having on the table of time with the quotation. They are clearly reforms in organisation. Organisations which are reforms. They seek to improve the condition of working people or sections of working people within the framework of the existing order. Right? Now, Marx was a revolutionary. What was their attitude to this then? It was unequivocal support. Unequivocal support. Why? Because of the whole argument that people develop course of experience and struggle. Marx said in a very striking phrase, the important thing about unions, and there were very small unions he was talking about at the time, is that they challenge the political economy of capital and assert the political economy of labour. Could have put it more simply, couldn't he? What's he actually saying? The bosses say wages, conditions, actually it's all determined by the market. I would dearly love to tell you more, if you have never been employer. But unfortunately, it is not in my hands. Market forces, etc., etc. In other words, the whole mythology, which must be very, very familiar to people since it has become popular again, not just in Britain on the factors, but on a world scale in the 80s, the notion of market forces determining objective forces, not human forces, and so on. That's the political economy of capital. And indeed, in the second half of the last century, it was being elaborated, whole series of economists seeking to show that there are objective laws, and so on and so forth, mythology, ideology, etc. Whereas the union, even if its leaders are actually liberals, liberals in the 19th century, of course they were, people considered this, nevertheless, by the very fact that they seek to interfere with these great objective laws, that they go in for horrible things like restrictive practices, shopping. This is a challenge, you see, Marx argued, to the whole notion, therefore, of market forces, what he called the political economy of capitalism, he supported on those grounds. Secondly, he supported on the grounds that by struggling to build organisation, you become fit to struggle against the system as a whole. Marx was not starry-eyed about the working class. You know, you have to go through 20, 30, 50 years of struggle, not only to the other side, but to make yourselves fit to rule. Whole notion of trade unionism, therefore, for Marx, was an essential part of the process whereby the working class arises at consciousness of itself as a class. Now, that's all very nice, except it tells us nothing at all about the internal problems. Now, just two quick points about that before I move on. There were reasons for this, and they were not actually the reason that Marx didn't really know very much about it, it wasn't very interesting, and so on and so forth. Basic reason, and this would be somewhat shocking perhaps to some colleagues, is that the problem of trade union bureaucracy was not a significant problem until the 20th century to some extent. Why not? Because again, with some exceptions, partial exceptions, in cotton textiles and in mining, the union organisation Marx was talking about was essentially the organisation of the spirit. Now let's keep clear. Today, there are very, very few skilled workers. Oh, there's large numbers who are called that. But very, very few skilled workers in the 19th century sense. And those workers are typically in fields like making jewellery and so on and so forth. What? Yes. Because you see, the 19th century stonemason, against the bar. Yes, when men are scarce, men are dear, turning around their arguing, you see. And so on. Therefore, restrict entry into the trade. That's the key to maintaining and improving wages. Also, therefore, effectual consciousness against the mass of the working class. And of course, as a matter of fact, against rival crack societies who are trying to elbow into our particular field and so on. Let's be quite clear. The left, the course of the 20th century, particularly the earliest of the 20th century, this was the end inside the movement. Marx was well aware of this, but in spite of this, he regarded the development of things like the Amalgamated Society of Woodworkers, the Amalgamated Society of Engineers, etc., as inherently progressive, because Marx was not a sectarian. You see, the essence of sectarian, insofar as it has a theoretical basis at all, is you take a photograph, you look at the reality as it is, you don't look at the process, its dynamics and its consequences, and seek to relate to those you wish to promote. Okay, let us move on. We come actually to the period of Russian Revolution, Communist International, Lenin's writings, and so on. What have they to say about the problem of trade union bureaucracy as such? Actually, comrades? Practically nothing. Now, don't misunderstand me. Of course, there was the argument against the right wing trade union leaders. Against the Amsterdam International, ghetto unionism, etc., etc., etc. Oh yes, that was that, right? But the argument was cast in political terms, essentially in political terms. The problem is, Gompers, the British trade union leaders and so on, they are right-wing social democrats, or worse, they are social traitors, etc., etc., etc. And what must we do? Build a rival international, you know, the whole notion of the Red International of Labour Unions. Now, a word of caution. That was not the same thing as simply seceding from the unions and so on. Lenin was far, far too experienced and sophisticated to go into like that. But nevertheless, the model, right, was essentially you build an organisation under a different, i.e., a revolution of its leadership. It is perfectly true that if you look carefully through the writings on the subject of the common terms, it's given to quite a lot of people, you will find arguments, particularly in the latter part of the period, about sectionalism, about capitalism, about the privileged layers and so on and so forth. That's the privileged layers of the country. The problem of bureaucracy as such has not suffered. Now why haven't it suffered? Why didn't strike Marx? It's perfectly obvious. He didn't exist. As a serious proposition, he didn't exist. Should have struck that in the curve. But of course their direct experience was basically Russian. And their any great experience in Western Europe was French. Lazovsky, who became the head of the Red International Labour Unions, his actual practical experience was that he was the secretary of a small tailors' union in Paris, a little craft society, a Jewish tailor, you see, and so on and so forth. Now, I have no doubt the problems of bureaucracy in a society of that sort were very small. He was probably the only full-time official, if indeed he was full-time. In other words, the notion of mass organisation and its peculiar problems did not impinge upon them. They realised, let me emphasise again, the treacherous role of the trade union leadership, the betrayal of 1914, etc., etc. They attributed it to political, if you like, ideological causes, plus, particularly in the case of Lenin, the mistaken notion that really the leaders of the German Trade Union Federation, the British CUC, rested on what he called a narrow layer of skilled privileged workers, which, not to put too fine a point on it, was bullshit. Well, it's factually completely incorrect. By the time he admitted, it was true in the 19th century, it was true in the early years of the 20th century. It has ceased to be true. And consequently, we find very little useful now. So we have to start more or less from the beginning. That is to say, not from us, we are not the beginning, but from the experiences that we developed from the 20s onwards, the communist movement and the war. I should, however, make one little digression here, and this will be a very good start. When I said you will find very little in the class of writings of the Marxists before a certain date, what class of means, I don't know, I have to think about it, because I went into one of Hackney's declining libraries and found this section entitled Classics. And it turns out classics mean books written before 1940. I'm one of the Maltese folk. By classics in this case, I mean up to 1923 or whatever. There was an exception. That exception was Daniel Dillian, and of course his immediate brother. Dillian, perhaps because he worked in the United States, most of his life in the United States, and the special circumstances there, the extreme weakness of organization on the one hand, but the existence of that society and some other unions with very corrupt and class collaborationist leaders who were open advocates of, you know, free enterprise, the American way, and so on and so forth, had his mind focused on the problem. He analysed the problem in terms not simply like. He says, what are these people? He calls them the labour lieutenants of capital. What are they? They're gangsters. And I would suppose he is, in other words, they are on the make, they are racketeers. Period. In this famous little pamphlet, Two Pages from Roman History, or it used to be famous anyway, it was an advertisement, he quotes the English experience as more advanced than the American, as indeed he was in these terms at that time. He quotes, looking at the prominent trade union leaders, Henry Broadhurst, William Abrams, and Richard Gow, and British Parliament, if you come in, please. Broadhurst was the most prominent of the old Liberal people, secretary of one of the stonemasons' unions. And he pointed out, member of Parliament, Broadhurst, leader of the stonemasons' union, at the same time he is a large holder of shares in the Brunner Mont Chemical Works in England, where 50% profit is made on the condition of vehicles slavery. Members of Parliament Abrams, this is Mabon, famous leader of the South Wales Miners' Federation, who, by an act of God, was killed in a railway accident in 1912 and been able left to take over the union. He's a leader of the Miners' Union. At the same time, he's a director of the London, Edinburgh and Glasgow Assurance Company. Member of Parliament, Bell, secretary of the Automated Society of Railway Service, which became the NUR of European Unions in 1912. And what was he done? I've forgotten what the opposed faction is. He wasn't on any board, but Dillian couldn't find a moment he got on to say. During the Tackdale Railway dispute, he was complimented by the Board of Trade's representative as a paper organiser who was capable of seeing that the question had two sides. And there are many, many more things of the same sort. What is the analysis? The analysis is a materialist analysis, yes. Why do they behave as they do? Because they are on the take. Because, in fact, the management is paying one way or another. Although a materialist analysis, comrades, it simply will not do. But it doesn't happen. They can't. Because the national union has seen them. Not since present of standing legal trustee. I think I don't need to say anything. But one of his predecessors, John Bell, who has Tom Gates, Sir Tom Gates, whom, on his retirement, to the general astonishment, since his salary was not all that large, opened a large nightclub in Dover. And when this was commented on, where did he get the money from? The Shipping Federation admitted, rather the secretary of the Shipping Federation admitted Yes, they had put up the money, they had given it as a donation, as a mark of Sir Thomas's splendid services to the industry over many years. Yes, that sort of thing happens, but it does not at all explain the nature of the bureaucracy. So now we come to this, and we come to it under the following case. First, the bureaucracy and the massive commitments. Secondly, the bureaucracy and the losses. Thirdly, the bureaucracy of the state. And then finally, we talk about the problems that revolutionaries have in this connection. First of all, the bureaucracy and the numbers. I will make an assertion, a bold assertion, which I thought would have to be qualified in detail, but it comes down to this. On the capitalism, and of course, trade unionism is a specific phenomenon, the wage labour system is unique to capitalism. On the large-scale working-class organisations, as opposed to small class societies, etc., are necessarily dominated by a layer of professional officials, by a bureaucracy. Why is this? Because, again, unlike the little Jewish Taylor Society in Paris that the Zotskys knew about as a secretary, the mass of the members, most of the time, are not actively engaged in the affairs of the organisation. That is a statement of fact, but it is also a statement which, when you think about it, is a necessary consequence of the condition of the working class under capitalism, ideological dominance of the other side, partial ideological dominance, except under conditions of great radicalisation or bitter sexual struggle. The root, therefore, of the root of the power of the bureaucracy, the existence of the bureaucracy, the power of the bureaucracy, lies in the members. In this sense, and in this sense only, the emphasis that the Communist International placed on ideas in this sense, as opposed to what the Communist Party in Britain later called, rather contemptuously called, our exclusive logical analysis, the emphasis on ideas is justified to this extent. Because of course it's true that if the mass of members of the EEPTU were up in arms, it would not actually be within any Hammond's power to do what he's doing. It would not have been in his power to conduct a scabbing operation at Wapping. If, but it's a rather large air, if, you know, 200,000 members were up demanding, protesting, passing resolutions, beating up the Jubilee Centre, dealing with them, etc., etc., etc. Notwithstanding the constitution that they managed to get, the highly authoritarian, and so it wouldn't be possible. No, the roots of the power of the bureaucracy lie in the normal condition of the membership. And it is absolutely essential that we understand that if we are to understand how revolutionaries operate. Second question, the question of the bureaucracy and the now, think about our service system. Look, on the face of it, very promising district. I mean, there are all sorts of difficulties in hospital districts. Very, very promising district. Certainly, there was no question that there was a great deal of indignation which could be built upon. You know, once you start a movement, goes forward, has some success, it can grow very, very rapidly. In fact, union leaders, new primarily, but also chosen, through a series of maneuvers, succeeded in demoralising, confusing, defusing the operation. Yes, they didn't succeed, they couldn't do it with Ed Hammond's staff, of course, I have to say. Thatcher, terrible, health service, plenty, everybody's interests, etc., etc. Yes, we must have a demonstration, yes, we must have a day of action, etc., etc. But these were means whereby, actually, a serious action was prevented. A serious action. Classic role of the trade union bureaucracy. They sell out. Now, given the nature of this audience, it's not necessary for me to go on about that. What it is important to say is, however, it is not always as simple as that. You look at this bureaucracy. It is, we say, just a distinct social level. It is not advanced. Even though some unions, the general municipal used to be an example, the official level has become quasi-hereditary. I remember, what was he called? What was it, Williams? Manchester district originally. Anyway, at one time, the district secretary, who was a much more important figure than the GM in many unions, was Paul Williamson, I think it was Williamson. No, it was Eccles, I'm sorry, it was Eccles. Williamson was the general. The general secretary was a Williamson. The full-time branch secretaries, two British branches, Pilkington, Hepsing, Adams, Pilkington, even another Wilkinson, a third largest branch in the area. He wasn't actually a Wilkinson, but he'd married one, his wife was a Wilkinson, you know. I mean, the thing really, but in spite of such excrescences, at the end of the day, the officials are withdrawn predominantly from the original. Including, by the way, people outside the training, you know, the recruiting through the universities and so on, not the working classes. But more importantly, rather than recruiting, where does their importance lie? Clearly, it lies in the organization. No organization, then the individual may make the transition to managing a nightclub or joining the House of Lords, etc., the individual leader, but as a layer, they are nothing. Nothing! Therefore, you see, the officialdom as a whole, and this applies both to its left wing and to its right, has a foot firmly planted in the working class camp. They are, in that sense, a part and an important part of the working class movement. People who don't recognise that are ultra left idiots. Now, that wouldn't matter if it was an abstract discussion in post hyperstructuralism or some damn thing or whatever. But it does matter. Now, I don't mind a federal abstract discussion. I'm not a philistine. But the point is that because working these organisations is, again, absolutely central to it, it's important to realise they have that foot in that camp. They have also a conservative layer, conservative with a small city, with an interest in a quiet life, with an interest in good relations with the employers. Leave aside the question of corruption. Yes, corruption occurs, but corruption is not the central problem. Yes, conservative layer, but they have a foot in the layer of organisation. That is what distinguishes. And the rest of them, from the leaders of the official Polish trade union organisation. Because they do not in any sense depend on any members. They're appointed on the Russian one. You know Andrew Pop, the man who is two people president. Yes, when he got in, he was boss of the secret police. Then he became the general secretary, had a bad heart and died, so someone else succeeded in that pressure. But what is interesting about Andrew is, do you know what he was in an earlier incarnation, before he became head of the KGB? He was head of the All-Russian Union Federation. He didn't make the transition, he didn't say that. He was appointed by the bureaucracy to one and the other. But now, genuine working class organisation, however corrupt, however reactionary the leadership, however backwards and endless, fundamentally different. And that means that the bureaucracy, I know it looks otherwise at the moment, the bureaucracies are not able to have a fixed static position for exactly what they want. Now, it is very, very hard, isn't it? We've got to have both theories of set outs to recognise that this is the case, but it's important to recognise it because, of course, it is one of the keys to understanding how we operate. The bureaucracy is not intrinsically tied to the employers, it is intrinsically tied to working class organisation. Its orientation is always towards social, don't individual exceptions, mavericks and so on, always towards social peace, class collaboration, etc., etc. the end of the day, the employers are not necessarily, except usually they are, but not necessarily. Indeed, we see a perception, come back to this moment, what people feel about the things that the enemy says, the business of the rest of the town. Oh, there's the real racing conflict. We used to be invited round to Downing Street regularly. We used to sit on this board and that committee, etc. We were consulted, we were treated with consideration, and so on. This woman doesn't do it anymore. Oh, it does not actually. It's not quite true. She doesn't do it in the same scale. The other orientation, the very importance, right, depends on their organisation. Someone could be influenced, which is quite considerable, but certain circumstances, of course. But the employers decide to get rid of the union altogether, if they can. And the most docile, the most servile bureaucracy, right, will not save the organisation. Why is it so? Rupert Murdoch, right? An FBA leadership side because it gives the soldiers. Then on there, right? Nevertheless, Murdoch decided to calculate as a result of the victories of the government and the employers between 1980 and 1985-6 that you were actually going to eliminate the unions. And he did. He did. It's not true that in doing so he was doing a service to the NGA leadership or SOGAP's leadership. It is certainly not true that they wanted it. It's true that their tactics led to defeat. They thought they could carry on. If class collaborationist policies, it would save them, of course it didn't. Their social position blinded them, but again, I emphasize the important distinction. The Murdochs, etc., can sometimes get rid of it. But, the organization they attached to. So much of the importance. Now that's a good brief bit, the question of trade unions in the state. I'm not going to spend much time on this, although it's intrinsically a very important topic. Although very important, not central to our immediate preoccupations in the here and now, for a whole number of reasons. I said earlier, you read through the vast literature, you will find very, very little on the problem of the trade union bureaucracy. And I also, borrowing the notion from happy public libraries, said that the classic means 1940. And it so happens that in 1940, Trotsky wrote a little article called Trade Unions in the Epoch of Imperialist Decay. It was, in fact, the last article he wrote, and he was murdered before he could finish it. Nevertheless, in substance it exists. That was actually published by a British Trot, I mean, the better friend of the British Trot, around 1944 and so on. Somewhere like that. And it contains the following argument. On the conditions of treating monopoly capitalism, tendency for monopoly capital to fuse with the state, etc., you know, state monopoly capitalism, all the rest of it, the analysis they have about that. Inevitably, there is an irresistible tendency to incorporate the trade unions in this structure. And this, he said, irrespective of the formal political character of the leadership. Now that's an advance, a significant advance. You recognise it's not the formal politics of the leadership. The reason he came to this conclusion is clear enough, clear to me anyway. He was in Mexico. Mexico, everyone's heard of the PRI now, haven't they? This is the recent newspaper, this is the recent death, right? The PRI dominated the state. At every level, it did not, however, dominate the union directly, who dominated the main union federation, the Communist Party. At that time, the Communist Party, coming down, etc. Nevertheless, and formally, of course, their formal politics are quite different from those of the PRI. In practice, obvious to Trotsky, what actually happened was a process of increasing integration, and, as he was wont to do, it was strong tendency. Union officials appointed to government jobs. Government officials smuggled into union jobs are coming together. A practical agreement. A tendency to absorption. And as I say, extrapolating, as he was prone to do, from a to, you know, therefore it's going to go to completion. Trotsky argued under late capitalism, imperialism, and so on, there can be no independent trade unions except, when I say there can be, there will be no independent trade unions, independent of the state, except insofar as they are led by revolutionaries. Led by revolutionaries, because we have got now some beginnings of an analysis of the bureaucracy, means that the membership is transformed. In other words, putting it in shorthand, accepting a revolutionary or semi-revolutionary situation. Now, we can see that that was wrong, can't we? That was wrong. Why is it wrong? Not because the reasoning is faulty, if you allow for a certain tendency to exaggeration and so on. No, but because the underlying assumption of the increasing tendency to a series of increasingly statized capitalisms was not realized. We have it. We criticized Trotsky. We held that view, of course, even more strongly than he did, for a long time. And it appeared to fit the reality. Absolutely no question about it. It appeared to fit the reality. However, contradictions, development of the long boom, the contradictions of the long boom led to a renaissance of, not with gas in the sense of big capitals and so on, but in a certain sense reproduced some of the elements of the competitive capitalism which Trotsky, like nearly everyone else, including Keynes, thought was dead, gone forever. Well, it wasn't. And consequently, the tendency to absorption by the state, what came to be called corporatism, already present, very obviously present in Britain throughout the whole period from about 1940 until that near 1980, actually, turning point to 1979, but you know, was a trend. But it was a trend to which there were all sorts of countervailing circumstances. Okay? That leads us to really the question of our operations. I'll start with Lenin. I'm just going to listen to Clifford picking up his formulation. Let me put it another way. Lenin said to German ultra-lefts who argue that German unions are hopeless, led by reactionary, counter-revolutionary bureaucrats, the members are idiots, etc., etc., failing reply in substance, if that is so, there will be no revolution in Germany. They thought, you see, the ultra-left thought they could somehow fight out the problem. You must work under all circumstances, however difficult, in the genuine mass organisations. It was in this connection that he gave this famous quote that you have to rely, sometimes you have to use deception, etc., etc. During the Cold War, no doubt since, but particularly during the Cold War, used to appear showing a character, you know, a character and so on and so forth, of the communists and all the rest of it. Every academic idiot used to reproduce it. And newspapers and so on, in that connection. The point being, the centrality of the notion that you work in mass organizations, and the mass organizations are the unions. That's not saying there are no other, but the mass organizations are the unions, health capitals, the regime, and the conditions for it, but democracy, under all circumstances. He uses in the same argument to fight the left wing communism the fact that the Bolshevik Party had drawn on its belly in order for its militants to work in unions, which in Russia, the beginning of the Tsarism, had been set up by the police. The police chief calls himself to believe in this kind of operation. Why? Because although these were police-initiated organisations, under the specific conditions of the time, they could become, to a certain degree, instrumental working class or working class organisations. Okay? Therefore, what? Under no circumstances whatsoever can we turn our back on the actual mass movement. Anyone who does that may be able to write Marxist articles about this and that, but it's utterly irrelevant from the standpoint of revolutionary is it in the situation of contradictory situation? I thought, on one hand, its importance comes from the organisation. No organisation, no importance. On the other hand, it's mass collaborationist, etc., etc. Not only that, but also it is not homogeneous, typically, most of the time, within itself. There is a left and a right. Now, of course, there was actually a difference. But they left different pressures, different backgrounds, different work situations, different conditions of various kinds. And this division of labour, if you like, within the bureaucracy is important. We have to start out by saying is important, which many comrades think. Rank and file good, official side, good. That's 100% what we need to know. Actually, it needs to know a bit more. The left and the right split, the split at the moment, after all, the left, the split to the CDC and the group, we are not mutual. We know that British, I'm going to say the villain, is a pathetic creature who will organise a chicken. That's not that word, you know? Even if he wanted to, but he doesn't. Nevertheless, and that is a formal head of, so many of them despise him, but he is the formal head of the majority of the bureaucracy. We are not mutual in the conflict between him and him, an able villain, if you want. We are for the preservation of the unity of the organisation if we can achieve it, and if we can't, we have a continuing struggle to recreate it. Now, why? Not because we are trade union captains and say, oh, the TUC Blue Book says this, the Brilliant Agreement says that. Stop the Brilliant Agreement. As a matter of fact, it was initially signed in 1939 for quite reactionary purposes. I don't want to go into the detail. The point is not that, but that the whole notion that working class organisation, however reactionism it is, however backward and so forth, is, as Marx put it, an assertion of the political economy of labour. We have to understand that it is an obstacle to the employers, it is a field for our operation, in spite of every sellout, in spite of everything. The split between the left and the right bureaucracies, which is clearly obviously therefore, is significant. Now, of course, there are those people who have firmly grasped this notion. I would laugh at people like the RCP who say, oh, they're all the same, hey, they're all skewed like male or whatever rubbish they talk. There's no difference. Of course, they laugh at that. But then, draw the conclusion, the central thing is to get more left of it. Yeah? After all, wouldn't it have made a difference if we had, in the case of new procurement health service disputes, instead of the current rather horrible lot, we had Alan Fisher. I mean, I've heard that argument. Because Alan Fisher actually has had some struggles, etc., etc. Partly that's an optical illusion, but you know, you get the general notion. If we had an Arthur Scargill, wouldn't it have made a difference? Yes. But it couldn't have made any fundamental difference. The whole notion here is we have a vested interest, obviously, in opposing the right. We have a vested interest. We are part of the left, inescapably, whatever we think of them individually and politically. But precisely because we understand that the bureaucracy do not sell out because simply they are a nasty lot, but that the thing is institutionalized and must be so under capitalism, our emphasis is always elsewhere. Our emphasis. Now, I'll go over this again in another connection, because it's very interesting. 1974, beginning of 1974, the then Tory industrial relations legislation, similar to the present, but all in one big package with some or two revisions, had taken an hell of a battle. But it was not yet there. And there was a dispute. And a top the AP engineering firm somewhere in Sussex, deepest Sussex, to meet the man, the adultery council, and so on and so forth. No, it was Surrey. I think it employed 7 or 8 workers. God knows what they did. 7 or 8 workers, one of whom was and became a party man. Briefly, it was a recognition dispute. These people wanted to assert the political economy of labour. They wanted to assert the capital. They wanted recognition to be master of the rolls, head of the civil judiciary, and of course you'll understand a thoroughly impartial fellow, was at that time the head of the Tory Industrial Relations Court. That fact played a leading role in writing the legislation, so the then would be suitable person for the job. He summoned them, some of the AUs there, and sure AUW at the time, you must stop this, we can't have it. We can't have it. You're out there, out with the law. Now then, the executive didn't shift. The executive didn't shift. And then, cut a long story short, they're faced with a position where the court said, bank will confiscate your entire assets. That's what they've done successfully and easily. Executive council divided three tracks out. Three to call a general strike of the entire management. It was decided in favour of a general stoppage by the president's casting vote. The court actually said he didn't have a casting vote, that was his reason too, it didn't matter. And what did you call that? The whole operation of the state, big sack of communist blood, corporate, nothing, and so on, collapse. Now then, so we ask ourselves, suppose Bill Jordan had been president. Yes? He was a man at the time. No position in boom, I think it was. Would it have made a difference? And the answer is unequivocally, yes, it would have made a difference. It would have led to a defeat. Because again, I come back to the question of the relationship between the power of the officials, the authority of the officials, and the level of consciousness of the members. Many members miles ahead of the officials, like many of them. The mass of the members, actually, not at all. Large numbers of them behind. The truth is, it was the official call that didn't. Now, people point to that and say, therefore, that's official. Come on. What made the action of elect officials decisive in those circumstances was precisely a level of radicalization on the ground. Precisely a history of recent struggles. Precisely, if you like, a rise in the level of basic elementary class consciousness. He was elected official in different circumstances. Our emphasis, therefore, has always to be work at the bottom. We say, rank and file. Without any illusions, the rank and file. Necessarily, at any given time, they cannot be behind the officials, especially in formal political terms, I tell you. But because it is the potential for revolt, that's central. The role of the officials, when there is a forward movement, is to seek to act as a break or to sell it out. Depending on their positions, the pressures on them and so on, they will behave in different ways, in different circumstances, but always as a break, and that does not matter what their forms of politics are. The brief working class movement wasn't too recent, but to some extent still is, littered with union leaders who are members of the Communist Party. Okay, you can say that the Communist Party is a rotten party and so on and so forth. No, it won't do. It's not as simple as that. It is the fact that the officialdom, unless there are extremely powerful countervailing forces, that is a party who disciplines its officials, which does not hesitate to expel them, however influential they are, and so on and so forth, they will inevitably be held by those. It is not so logical that GSP was regarded as something of a militant, isn't it? How has it actually behaved? This year? Last year? Yeah? You know? The voice is the voice of the left, but the hands are the hands of Bill Jordan, etc., etc. That is in substance the reality of the thing, isn't it? Okay.